Welcome, on behalf of the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary, to the next of our book talks, which we're holding this year a number, and you know why you're here, so I'll just say a few words about it. By way of background, these book talks have really been a wonderful institution that we began a few years ago here, and by virtue of our outstanding and very productive faculty who have been willing to donate their time to present on the books that they have written or edited, and often in some combination thereof, we've really been able to bring attention to our collective book culture here at the seminary in a way that until this program began is really unprecedented. And it's a wonderful opportunity for all of us to learn from the many on our faculty, and we've even added some beyond alumni in fields that are not necessarily our own. Also, speaking for myself, as the director of the library, I've taken the responsibility not only to set up these talks, but to read each and every one of the books that we have featured. And I've got to tell you that it's a privilege and a pleasure that you cannot imagine. Every book which has been spoken about by our faculty, new books in the range of fields, has been something that I've enjoyed in recent time, and I recommend it to you. Tonight, as you know, we're going to be hearing from Carol Engel regarding her new edited book, The Women Who Reconstructed American Jewish Education. At the beginning of her introduction, she, with distinctive clarity, quite typically, tells us exactly what the book is. And I think it's just worth reading that to you. The Women Who Reconstructed American Jewish Education introduces the unheralded educators who planted the seeds of social reform and progressivism in the soil and soul of American Jewish education. It highlights 11 eminent women who either informed the educational philosophies of the 20th century's most influential Jewish pedagogues, Samuel Benderly and Mordechai Kaplan, or put them into practice. It is a wonderful range of essays, all of which is illuminating. I must say that Carol's are, of course, the most illuminating. So we're very pleased that she, as both author and editor, will be addressing the topic. The only thing I have to add, for those of you who have been around the Jewish Theological Seminary for some time, I must say that the essay to which you must turn as immediately as possible is Carol's essay on Sylvia Ettenberg, which is just extraordinary. A lot of fun, because it's a personality who affected this institution in very direct and profound ways. But all of the essays are wonderful, and it reminded me, I mean, by this point, we take for granted the fact that history and academic studies in general have made it our collective responsibility to address the stories, to address the histories that in an earlier stage of scholarship were simply neglected. Real history didn't include the history of people, of women like this. We fortunately now live in an age where we can at least far more often take it for granted that these histories are going to be part of the general history. Speaking for myself, we sometimes take it so for granted that we forget how relatively new and how radically important this is. If you take the time to read this volume, I can assure you, you will be reminded of how radically new it is and how important to broaden our vision so that it includes everybody who contributed to this very important field amongst many others. Carol.
That was very gracious, David. Thank you. Another benefit for me, who has attended a number of these book talks and certainly have heard my fellow faculty members present at our faculty lunch and learns, is sometimes our faculty members raise questions in their research that we get a chance to grapple with in ours. So you all know, or many of you know, the axiom that mitzvah gereret mitzvah, that a mitzvah begets another mitzvah. Well, sometimes mechkar gorer mechkar, that research generates other research. So one of the factors in my synthesizing the work of my own work and the work of others was something that I read in Alan Mintz's wonderful book, thank you, Hebrew in America. And Alan threw out a challenge, and I thought, actually, I think I may have the answer to it. And the challenge that Alan had written about was trying to figure out how it was that the Hebraists and the Zionists of an earlier period didn't really make the kind of enormous impact on American Jewish society, but they did make a huge impact in the world of American Jewish education. And he said, the story of how a small band of Hebraists kidnapped the Talmud Torah movement and retained control of it for several decades needs to be told. And I said, I think I'm going to tell that story. So my response to that question, or the challenge, was that the kidnappers were primarily women, and they were the women who were influenced in part by Samuel Benderley, but even more by Mordecai Kaplan. I would say that what these women did was to create a utopian revolution, a pink-collar revolution, but a utopian revolution. It was utopian in that it was something that hadn't happened before. It was not restorative. It was not looking back at an earlier era. It was really trying to create something anew. And what they were trying to do was make social and educational and political change. And that the vehicle, the lever for making that change was Jewish education. And they were ultimately, what happened was that even though there is very little of that Hebraist, Zionist content in the congregational school of today, what they did create was what Naomi Cohen, in talking about American Zionism, referred to as creating a kind of Jewish elite, a Jewish elite for the American community, and really bringing Zionism into the bloodstream of American Jewry. So what I would suggest is, the other thing that's powerful about this revolution is that in some ways it is like a series of those stacking Russian dolls, the Matryoshka dolls. The outer shell was Hebraist, Zionist, but inside were multiple revolutions, and some of those revolutions actually did remain. So I'll go through what I consider those sub-revolutions were. So the first was the establishment of an American Jewish synthesis. This was a revolution in identity, that you could wed Jewish history, culture, and values comfortably with American history, culture, and values. Another one of those stacking dolls was establishing a synthesis between contemporary educational theory, contemporary in its time. The period of the book is 1910 to 1965, so this is a heyday of American progressivism. a synthesis between that educational theory in general education and Jewish education, and it made a real revolution in Jewish education in that the places where Jewish education happened, the curriculum for the Jewish school, what constitutes Jewish cultural literacy, all of that changed as well. So the story of these multiple revolutions really begins with the dynamic duo with Benderlane Kaplan. And for those of you who don't really know these fellows, I'm going to go, well, Kaplan's name I'm sure you know, but many people don't know Samson Benderly's name at all. And I'll go through that quickly. We'll have you have opportunity to ask questions. You can flesh it out. But it was Kaplan who brought Benderly to America in 1910. And Benderly headed up the newly founded Bureau of Jewish Education, the first BJE, the Central Agency for Jewish Education in the United States. And it was a statement that Jewish education is a communal responsibility. And Benderly was a genius of a talent scout himself. And he brought bright young men who were studying across the street, Teachers College, graduates of generally City College, getting doctorates to go into secular education, and he convinced them that they really belonged in Jewish education, and he convinced Kaplan to work with him, creating a program study for these people. Often they had come from observant homes, but they really hadn't studied Jewish education in any depth. And the traditional story is it was Benderly and the Benderly boys who revolutionized American Jewish education. So in calling my book, The Women Who Reconstructed American Jewish Education, I'm privileging Mordecai Kaplan. And it was he who used the Teachers Institute as a training ground, largely for women. And he wasn't such a big feminist. We all know the story that, yeah, his daughter, 1922, the first bat mitzvah, but he actually, in his diaries, bemoaned the fact that 70% of the Teachers Institute population were women. But it was these women who learned at Mordecai Kaplan's feet what it was like to create this incubator for the American Jewish community. And if I had had my brothers, I would have called the book The Women Who Kidnapped American Jewish Education. But University Press, Brandeis University Press, was a little too sitterdick. They were too nervous about that title. The kidnapping's a bad word. Have you no sense of irony? but anyway, so I didn't.
Well, you know what would happen if you Googled it. You know?
That's right. Well, yeah, that's right. So we settle for reconstructed. So the American Jewish synthesis, let's start with Benderly's version of the American Jewish synthesis. And I'm going to quote from his remarks at the founding of the BJE, and he is giving his remarks to the Kihila, the organization that set up the BJE, and you'll hear what I mean by utopian revolution. Never before in Jewish history has so large a Jewish community as we form in this country had both the opportunity and the responsibility of proving that the essentials of Judaism, so far as from being in contradiction to the cardinal elements of modern civilization, are complementary to them, the two sides being mutually indispensable to each other. Constituting an integral part of the Republic, we are under an obligation to demonstrate that the principles for which Israel fought and bled over 2,000 years are perfectly compatible with and essential to the fundamental principles upon which the American nation is building a wonderful structure of human liberty and happiness. Our obligation is twofold. On the one hand, we must Americanize, in the higher sense, every Jew in the country, infusing into him the spirit of self-reliance, fair play, and social cooperation. And on the other hand, we must build up the structure of Jewish life so as not only to enable ourselves to hold our own, Jewishly speaking, but also to become an indispensable element in the progress of this country. So we're going to Americanize the Jew, and we're going to Judaize these Americans who are these newly identified Americans who have left behind some of the gold along with the dross of the old country. How do you operationalize this ideal? So I'm now reading from the notes that were taken at the principals' meetings, which Benderly convened at the BJE. It is necessary to bring home to the children the grandeur of Jewish history, the heroic struggle and the unparalleled martyrdom of the Jewish people for the sake of its ideals, to arouse their pride in our great past, and to stir their enthusiasm for the endeavors marking the Jewish revival of our own days. Footnote for me, Jewish history had not really been in the curriculum before. The national American holidays, which are purely secular in character, such as the 4th of July, Decoration Day. Young people, do you know what Decoration Day is? No, not a one. Who can tell them what Decoration Day is? Memorial Day. You would go and decorate the graves of the soldiers. Okay. So Decoration Day and Thanksgiving Day should be celebrated in the Jewish schools. In the Jewish schools. We're not talking day schools, friends. We're talking about the congregational schools. Instead of the regular instruction, which should be discontinued, the patriotic significance of these holidays should be brought out. And whenever possible, the relation of these holidays to similar events in Jewish history should be pointed out. Benderly saw no contradiction between Americanism and Judaism, and they could be synthesized, integrated. Kaplan was a much more nuanced personality. Every time I read these remarks, which were written by Ira Eisenstein, his son-in-law, I just feel the angst. The first occasion when being a Jew became a problem to me was when, as a child of 7, I migrated with my mother and sister to Paris at the same time that father, whose long rabbinical training had qualified him for a Jewish academic or rabbinic post, migrated to America. Coincidentally, he was going to work for the Kehila, and he was going to be one of the rabbis under the chief rabbi of New York. On the second Sabbath after our arrival, I remember attending school and being asked to write out some lesson. In order not to transgress the prohibition of the Sabbath, I told a fib. I said that my hand hurt me. The next Sabbath, I stayed away from school. My predicament was solved during the week following. My mother found a small apartment in the Jewish section of Paris. Their children were free from school on Saturday and Sunday instead of Thursday and Sunday, as in the schools of the rest of the city. The second occasion, when being a Jew became a problem, was about a year later, when my mother, sister, and I were aboard a French steamer bound for New York. They were joining father. We were in steerage. It was Friday night. announcement had been made that there would be fireworks on deck in honor of Bastille Day. I was eager to join the crowd to see the fireworks, but my mother would not permit me to go before reciting my Sabbath Eve prayers. By the time I was through, the fireworks were over, and I was left heartbroken. Since then, I've been living in two civilizations, the Jewish and the non-Jewish. So it's not this easy articulation, this easy fit. And of course, Mordecai Kaplan was influenced by Horace M. Callan and Emil Durkheim, the communitarianism, the fact that it was not about being in a melting pot, it was about the symphony orchestra, and that America revitalized itself not by having everybody being forced to emulate an Anglo-Saxon norm, but by allowing each person to draw on the comforts of his or her own ethnic group. And he also differed with his friend Benderling on the role of synagogue and religion. And he thought that only by giving Jewish culture a distinctively religious significance in the true modern sense of the term, is there any hope of Jewish education being built up in this country. This means that only maintaining the synagogue and vitalizing it by means of the Hebraic movement can the Jews hope to survive here as a distinct group. Benderly was very skittish about rabbis, and he was banking on educators to be the foot soldiers of the Hebraist Zionist movement. So I said that was one of the nesting dolls inside Hebraism and Zionism, the idea of the American Jewish synthesis. Another one was the synthesis of American progressive education and Jewish education. So unlike the American Jewish synthesis here, Benderly and Kaplan were generally in agreement. And Benderly said, really echoing the words of somebody like a John Dewey, although there's no indication that we know of that he read Dewey or studied Dewey, that Benderly leaves very little for us to work with in terms of historical primary source material. But Benderly told the principals, a Hebrew teacher who does not know the American Jewish youth, who does not understand his environment, who fails to distinguish the noble elements in American life from its sordid materialism, and does not know how to make use of its better aspects in order to combat the objectionable features of the environment, such a teacher, no matter how great his devotion to Jewish ideas, is useless in a Jewish school. So you're going to Americanize the immigrant, you're going to look to public school for models. He was very aware of child psychology. And by the way, the same is true of Kaplan. So what was their educational philosophy? First and foremost, Ivrit be Ivrit. Second, you teach Hebrew through speaking Hebrew. The second was professionalization. We've got to professionalize the educational field. And they end up thinking about two tracks, one for administrators and one for teachers. And I'll get back to that later. There is a communal responsibility for Jewish education. And the centerpiece is going to be the communally funded Talmud Torah. Before the Talmud Torah, pre the Kehillah's decision to bring in Benderly, the Talmud Torah was for the children of the poor. They were for orphans, and anybody who could afford it had a private tutor. Obviously, the people who were sent to the cheder. The period that I'm talking about is 1910 to 1965. In some ways, it's like from one Roth to another, from Henry Roth's, you know, Call It Sleep in 1914, and that horrible cheder, that he depicts. And then Philip Roth, it's not quite 1965, in 1959, the conversion of the Jews, that horrible synagogue school that he depicts with the rabbi who is not meeting the kids' needs at all. So communal, not synagogue school. That Jewish schooling would be retrofitted around the public school. The public school was what made America, America. It made it the Golden Medina. And you had to keep the public school. Day school, old world, not going there. Schools for girls, schools for preschool, schools for high school girls, adult education, particularly for women. Why the influence, why the interest in education for women? Because nobody cared about the education for women. It didn't count. What people were concerned about was the education for boys. So this was, you know, free territory. So they could do all kinds of experimentation, model schools, camps and after-school programs. And then I would say the influence of social Darwinism, the belief that you can change a culture through social tinkering, and education was the way to do it. So I want to get to the professionalism and gender issue, because I think that's at the heart of the book. What happened in progressive education was there were two strands. There was the Deweyan strand, which really kept pushing the pay attention to the interests of the child. The literature calls it child-centered. I don't really think it was ever child-centered. The children weren't really choosing the curriculum. The only place that was happening was in Auntie Maine somewhere, you know, or maybe Little Red Schoolhouse down in the village. They weren't choosing the curriculum, but it was child-informed. They were aware of the needs of children. So they got it from the settlement house folks. The sinks and the faucets were child-sized. They were playgrounds. So this is child-informed. And the other branch of Dewey's of progressive education ended up being very technocratic. Half of those buildings, and Meredith would know, as a graduate of TC, half of those buildings are named after these people, Rugg and Thorndike, and they were people who were very big on testing and administration and being efficient, the efficiency experts, and that was the influence that the Benderly boys were getting, because they were doing doctoral work over at TC. Whereas Kaplan was bringing a kind of Deweyan progressivism, this child-informed experimentation or pedagogy to the women. So the women ended up, I think, doing the work that actually hit more people. The followers of Benderly ended up in bureaus of Jewish education, as heads of bureaus of Jewish education, as heads of the denominational agencies that were overlooking education, and they didn't have the contact with the people in the classrooms. They were farther and farther away from the real work of teaching. I mentioned that another one of the revolutions was revolutionizing where Jewish education took place, and I think we've gotten a little of that: classrooms, camps, clubs, and youth groups in women's organizations. The changing content of Jewish education, it was more than Chumash and Rabbinics. It was Hebrew as a living language. It was importance of history. It was about Israel. It was about the arts. It was about music, adding music to the curriculum, adding Jewish literature. So after 1965, I think the largest of the dolls cracked apart. The Heber is Zionist, the container for the other revolutions. But what remained was the innards, the smaller dolls inside. And I would say the influence today, we can feel it in a very pronounced way. Adult education, particularly for women, look who's taking most of the Mayotte classes, most of the Melton classes, our context. It's usually disproportionate. There are more women than men. Certainly any education that's being done. Look at Hadassah. I mean, there's an organization that's always taken Jewish education so strongly. And Hadassah features prominently in this book. The interest in early childhood education, I hope that we here will soon see some kind of program in early childhood education at JTS. The arts as a portal for Jewish studies. Demands for professionalization, we're still talking about it. Certainly that the child-informed message has come through. Importance of camps, importance of Zionizing, if there's such a word, Zionizing America. I mean, that was largely due to these people. The irony, I think, and we can talk about that in our Q&A period, is the two biggest problems for Jewish education today, what are they? Hebrew and Israel. How do we teach Hebrew? How do we teach Israel? Which is stunning. So why did the revolution fail? How many of you saw A Serious Man? The Coen brothers. Makes you cry. Another depiction of, like the Philip Roth depiction, the serious man is supposed to take place in 1967.
Set Rose Park.
And it's Dan. If you haven't seen it, Danny Gopnik is on the cusp of his bar mitzvah, and he's in Hebrew school, and he's listening to pop music on his Walkman as his bumbling classroom teacher is conjugating verbs. Well, that was not what the Heberist Revolution was about. The last scene in the movie is this tornado coming to hit that synagogue and coming to hit that school. So what was the tornado? And very quickly, what I think the tornado was, in other words, why did this wonderful revolution fail, was it was built for an urban world, not a suburban world. It was built for a community where you walked to school and or you took public transportation and you went to a communal Talmud Torah. The suburbs led us to the synagogue as the locus of the school. And every rabbi wanted to hear the pitter-patter of little feet in his building, and I say his advisedly. And the synagogue school became all about synagogue skills and preparation for bar and bat mitzvah. And so I would say to Kaplan, be careful what you wish for. You might get it. This is what happened when the synagogue became the center. Then, too, American Jewish education was built around the public school. What happened in 1957 that changed what we thought about public schooling in America? Yeah. Well, I remember it. Sputnik. And the whole question about what were American schools doing? If the American school is going to be tainted, then the schooling, the Jewish schooling that was built around it, picks up some of that taint. Progressive education in general was under attack, and we went to this back to basics movement in America. I would also say it was a lessening of the impact of the Hebrew teachers' colleges on American life, and Judaic studies moved out to campuses, and you didn't have to go to one of these teacher training institutions to get your Judaica. I would also say that ethnicity and communitarianism were giving way to the Jew within, and the concern for the big questions and spiritual meaning that weren't being addressed, frankly, by some of the people in my book. The growth of Jewish day schools, really hammering the synagogue school. And then I think the critique of Israel after 1967 also led to that. So what I would like to do is stop and give you an opportunity to ask some quick clarification questions. Just things that you didn't understand, I went over too quickly, questions on the conceptual frame.
To whom the audience was for these innovations, was this a group of people who were, as a friend of mine would say, were on the bus? They came from Jewish homes, they had a Jewish home life, and what was happening in these schools was a pedagogical reinforcement and augmentation of what was in their kishkes, these kids, when they were 4, 5, 6 years old. They had an idea that they were Jewish. They were not going to school to become Jewish. They were not coming from a home which was do as I say, not do as I do.
Right. I think that you're raising a good question. These were first-generation Americans. So there may have been a lot of the Yiddishkeit that they had picked up at home. And maybe that's another explanation of why it didn't work so well 2-3 generations down. Any other kind of general questions? Yeah, Rachel?
I understand how you explained why this the Hebraicizing revolution didn't work in the suburban setting, but can you speak a little bit about why it was successful in the urban settings?
The suburbs immediately demanded that somebody drive a kid to the school.
Mm-hmm. What?
Somebody had to drive a kid to the school. And I'm a product of one of these Talmud Torahs. I went 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. And that was the norm. Mm-hmm. And when the schools moved, and I'm giving you a real facile answer, Rachel, but I think there's some merit here. The shrinking of the hours was made it impossible to have the kind of rich curriculum and reinforcement. Not only did we go, 10 hours a week, but we put on plays in Hebrew, and we would stay after on a Sunday to rehearse, and you just couldn't do that as well. So that was one thing. And the other thing was, it was I think the suburbs made the change in the curriculum. It was going to be in the synagogue, then you were going to teach synagogue skills, and you were going to teach these other good things. So another, just a clarification.
Yeah, I never heard this difference between cheder and Talmud Torah. The Talmud Torah was for the poor kids, and cheder was for kids whose parents could pay?
No, I didn't say that. No, I'm glad you asked.
Oh, okay.
No,
so
the cheder, you did have to pay for, but it was very different from having a private tutor. The wealthiest had a private tutor for their children.
No, I understand that.
Right.
What if you were, there were middle-class people in the early part of the century. Where did their kids get Jewish education?
They went to the Chadarim, and they suffered.
Yeah.
The horrible stories about how awful Hebrew school was are not necessarily born up in out in the research of the kids who went to school in the 70s, actually. I have a doctoral student who's just putting the final touches on her dissertation. Those horrible stories, most of those horrible stories, are hangover from the Cheder period. Yeah. There may have been some Chederim that weren't terrible.
Yeah, my father went to one, too. He went to. Yeah. What about the kids who went to Sunday school?
Thank you. There were kids who went to Sunday school, absolutely. There were only 25%. Let's get a figure out here. There was a survey done. Only 25% of the kids, the eligible kids in 1910, were getting any Jewish education. So if we all want to, you know, glorify, you know, our, you know, every one of us, you know, had a wonderful educated parents and grandparents, but it wasn't true. Yeah.
I also went to the five-day-a-week Talmud Torah and continued on to Marshalia. Was there a mention, you mentioned something about teachers' seminary. Is there any mention within the book about Marshalia, Herzliya, the continuation on to Hebrew high school while going to public school?
Yeah, I mean, there were schools like that in New York, and there were schools like the one I went to, which was the Prosdor of the Hebrew Teachers College. But these kids were wanting more and more and more, and they recreated their worlds. Like my story on Sylvia Ettenberg is that she had this wonderful Talmud Torah, and wherever she went, she recreated that environment. So she continued on. She couldn't get, there was no Prosdor here, and one of the reasons why she established a Prosdor was that she went to some Hebraist place under Orthodox auspices. Right now, I can't remember. But she wanted to go on to Hebrew high school, just like you probably wanted to continue.
So. That was our teenage rebellion.
Yes, right, to high school. Right. What I'll do, we have a few minutes, so I think we have time to do it. I put together some blurbs about some of the women in the book, things that they said or things that people said about them. I have a feeling that some of you in this room may know these people. I think I'm willing to bet that everybody in the room will know at least one person on the list. And what I'd like you to do is think about what I said in terms of the conceptual framework about the synthesis. They're coming around. Move along. Move on. think about the conceptual framework that I laid out about the nesting dolls, about the multiple revolutions, and see if there are people there whose names kind of jump out of the page at you. And does it ring true with your experience? Do these people sound like the? Do these people seem to fit in this grid that I've laid out? Okay, so take a minute or two, and we'll have a few questions from the sheet, and you can. I know that the temptation for you to wax on about some of your reminiscences is going to be very, very strong. So sit on the impulse, if you can, and be as parsimonious as possible, because I think that people are going to be wanting to talk. And we want to give as many people an opportunity and still get you out. Okay. Well, anybody want to start? Howard, again. Okay, Howard, this is the second time. Something you've asked
graduates of the SAJ, the Society for the Advancement of Judaism, Mordecai Kaplan's second synagogue. and gracing the entrance or the back of the synagogue originally was this beautiful mural that Tamima Ghazari painted. She went to Israel for, I think she spent 2 years there, and she was a muralist, and that mural now is still in the SHA upstairs in the social hall, and it's called Elements, New and Old Elements in Palestine, and it's this very charming portrait of the Hasidim, you know, davening away there, and the Chalutzim picking the fruit, and the Arabs, you know, doing their thing.
And yes, there's a lab. There's science laboratory at the Hebrew University.
And it was this wonderful utopian vision of Zion, you know,
right.
of Palestine,
right.
of what it was becoming. And it was very, I could just see people walking in and out of that synagogue, gazing at that mural, and having a real sense of racial pride.
That's right. Definitely right. She studied with Diego Rivera. This was amazing. Amazing. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So there's that sense of that Zionism and it makes your heart beat a little faster. Anybody else? Anybody whose name you recognize here? Do you remember?
It's time handbooks for our children.
Of course.
I mean, every day.
Yeah.
It was a big treat on Shabbos. Your congregation, we were really little. It's
hard to believe, but there were only didactic children's books. There was no Jewish children's literature to speak of. Tauntaun, which is still a good read, and another one by, I don't know if you anybody here is from the Midwest, but Libby Braverman wrote Children of the Amic. You know that? That's also a good read. And in this weird world, you know, you could do social network analysis on these women. Tamima Ghazari illustrated the Tauntaun books. Tamima Ghazari illustrated the Libby Braverman books.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other connections too. Rebecca Brinkner is in the book. She was the wife of Balfour Brinkner. Barnett Brinkner. Balfour was their son. And she was the one who brought Libby Braverman to Cleveland, to the Fairmont Temple. Anybody else?
Yeah, I recognize Zipporah Yaakov from the Hebrew Art School, which is probably, I guess, is across the street from where the Center of Jewish History is.
No, not the Center of that was one address. Yeah, they moved there several times. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
That was where the Jewish Guild for the Blind was, I think,
also,
that
yeah.
neighborhood. Yeah. They ended up on a handsome piece of property at 67th Street. And Tamima and Zipporah Yoxberger was hired by Sylvia Ettenberg to teach Khalil at the first Camp Ramah. She taught here too.
I studied
close to me.
R. A. Davidson studied.
Well, did you learn how to play the halula?
And Tamima. I was in the joint firm. We had to study.
It was mandatory at that time that you had to take music, the teaching of music, and the teaching of art.
Cool.
Yeah. Anybody else? Comments.
I remember Barry Holt and Eddie Ralph and the rest of the people. They used to meet all the time for things.
What?
Eddie Ralph and Barry Holt used to bring Tamima in a lot for.
This was I think Jan's talking about the Melton Research Center doing programs. I see there are people who did not grow up in New York. In this room.
It is possible that
even though my book does center, has a very New York centric base. I didn't plan it that way. The kind of education that I and my sisters-in-law, who were in the room, got at the Hebrew Teachers College, then it was the Hebrew Teachers College in Boston, was very similar. And some of the wonderful teachers that I had in when I was in Talmud Torah, even though they didn't get this flavor from the going to the Teachers Institute, they certainly did going to the Hebrew Teachers College and going to Boston University or to Boston State Teachers College, and they made that synthesis.
Alan? Say that the Ohio River Valley, the Mississippi Valley, is a whole other nexus of those large cities there, especially Minneapolis, St. Paul, where Dan Olizar's father was the head of the Bureau of Jewish Education, Asala Freeland, Cleveland.
Absolutely.
Many places were very strong Hebraist strongholds, and I think they probably followed the model of there was a male who was the head of the bureau, but the chief assistants and the people on the ground were women. And,
right.
So it's not just New York and not just New England.
And Philadelphia, of course. Mm-hmm.
And Schenectady, New York. Okay. We had a Bureau of Jewish Education, and it was a communal school where all the synagogues pooled money, I suppose, and teachers, and it worked. I think we also went 5 days a week, plus going to junior congregation was part of it. And as a result, many of the people I'm speaking about who were students there, rabbis there, people who were in Jewish education, and wonderful fruits of something like that.
But in Baltimore, most of my teachers in Hebrew High School, except for Ivrit, for Safa, and I'm for Sifrut, were male. I think they were.
Yeah, all male. Yeah.
Except for people who taught you how to conjugate verbs. Every single one of them. I never had a female. I don't have one female teacher. And after the ninth grade, I never had a female teacher except for this stuff. And after ninth grade, I didn't have one female teacher ever.
I think that was true of the Hebrew College, the Froster, too. I had women teachers until I got to high school. And
I don't remember.
But I think that happens, the gender stuff changes in public education. Right.
And they all had PhDs, like either from Warsaw before the war, or during the war. None of them were American, very few were American. Or they had doctorates, like from the University of London during the war. There were a couple of Americans, and they were all published.
Yeah.
And they were all scholars, and they were not such engaging pedagogues.
Right.
My mother said to me, your job is to sit at the feet of scholars and study, and I don't care if you don't go to sleep, you do all your homework.
Well, I will say that Kaplan, in his diary, looks at the Benderly boys teaching. They were teaching here. And he thought they were terrible teachers. Yeah.
Just going to mention, going back to the historical change that you mentioned, when you looked at the suburb, I think it's part of a larger post-war existential crisis about the meaning of religion in American life. We begin to think about Protestant, Catholic, and Jew, and the definition of the Jewish enterprise, despite the state of Israel, becomes more religious, and the Hebraic Zionist ideology that had in the ideological undergirding for this was not prepared, as you mentioned before, to respond to this shift in the self-understanding of the Jewry. And rabbis thought they were, but certainly the people in charge of the bureaus and so forth, having a national culturalist conception of Jewish culture, couldn't do it. Although many elements, and there's something that maybe could mention more, is that the culture of these schools were modeled in part on Yeshua, especially, dancing and folk songs and so forth, and this Achad Am translation of what we think of as mitzvot of halacha into customs and ceremonies was also part of this program. And that soft peddling of religion, per se, became less acceptable at this turn in the late 40s. It was part of the demographic shift, but also something larger in American Jewish life.
it was at its heart secular. That doesn't mean to say people weren't observing in their homes or observing outside, but it was a secular movement, and people were looking for a religious, spiritual set of answers. I agree with you. Anybody else? Maybe a last question? At your home? John.
The Bender Loop piece, where it's, you said that it's hard to know what really influenced him in terms of primary sources.
Yeah. He grew up in Swat. Where did he get this? He was studying to be an ophthalmologist. At Johns Hopkins. Here he was, you know, every Jewish parent's dream. Listened to Jewish education.
It just remains a question
mark. It's a big question.
Because you can't really...
He didn't write. Mm-hmm. He didn't write. He was a doer.
His grandchildren still alive, you could ask.
What he's saying is that in order to, what it means to study Judaism is about giving something to the American experience, to illuminate.
Well, two parts.
Right,
one is we're going to learn from the American experience.
Right.
The second is we have something to teach.
Right. That's pretty
cool. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that. We want it in?
You, yes, Tom? Perfect.
Okay. Thank you very much.
First of all, thank Carol. Again, wonderful opportunity to study and learn. Please look for notices of future book talks. If you're not on our email list, please get in touch with us, and you know, we'll put you on the list so you get those notices. I do want to say before closing that since Mordechai Kaplan was a central part of the discussion this evening, not long ago the library scanned the entire diaries of Mordechai Kaplan. So you have available to you now not simply the published excerpts, but the entirety of the diaries. They are absolutely wonderful, not just because of the completeness of it, but also because he was a very meticulous diary writer and clearly had a sense that he would be read, that his diaries would be read. So you have an opportunity to read his rewriting of his own thoughts in his diary to himself. It's Kaplan and counter Kaplan all at once. A wonderful opportunity.
15% of the diaries in Hebrew.
And yes, that's right. So please take the opportunity to look at our digital library and come back for future book talks. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.